This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, more than a year ago, gave birth to a new generation of civil rights leaders. One of them, speaking in Normal this week, says it's everyone's responsibility to understand the magnitude of the Black Lives Matter movement.
If you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention.
St. Louis area minister Osagyefu Sekou talks with GLT's John Norton. And you'll hear about a pilot program for Bloomington police body cams from Mayor Terry Renner. The mayor will also answer your questions about an uptick in revenue and the good news for the city's solid waste fund. And during an edition of Animal House, hear about one of the community's recently established animal rescue groups. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's October 13th, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. One of the key services putting Bloomington's budget into the red is solid waste, with about 50% of the deficit in the solid waste fund coming from the cost to pick up brush and bulky waste. The Bloomington City Council is receiving some good news that changes in how often brush and things like couches and appliances are picked up is working to save the city money. As he does following most Monday evening council meetings, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner joins us in the studio. Thanks, Mayor, for taking the time to join us during Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Mike.
We'll talk about solid waste, police body cams, and the recently approved sales tax for a moment. Terry, again, thanks for joining us. You can join this conversation at 309-438-8910. Terry, people aren't being laid off to accomplish savings in the solid waste fund. Where are the savings coming from?
Well, essentially, they're being redirected and getting given positions in other places, many of them in Parks and Rec. So we are definitely taking advantage of kind of recalibrating our efforts in solid waste. You don't always have to raise fees. You know, at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to take advantage of enough of those economies to close that massive gap. But we've definitely made some progress. It seems like it'll be several hundred thousand dollars that we will save over the course of a year. And obviously, that's serious money as we're trying to close a budget gap.
How far do you have to go to actually break even? Is it another $1.5 million?
It's well over $2
million.
The Budget Task Force actually recommended to the City Council as a policy that you reduce the deficit to $1.5 million. So that's something that the council is still going to need to do. We've saved several hundred thousand here, but we've still got close to a million more that we need, or approximately that, you know, as we move forward. So that might be charging more for first bucket and maybe a second bucket for the pickup. It might be charging $2 or so per or $3 increase in you know, to each household for the service. We don't know what that'll be, but we do need to basically close this gap.
The Community Budget Task Force touched on this. We've talked about it, and I'll ask you again. If garbage pickup and the collection of brush and bulky waste is a public good, then why is the Solid Waste Fund an enterprise fund that has to pay for itself, that has to break even through the fees and whatever money it can derive?
Well, about 5 years ago, the previous council and the previous mayor made a decision to make this an enterprise fund. An enterprise fund's supposed to pay for itself. The problem is that the council and mayor agreed on that as a policy, but they never followed through to make sure that the fund paid for itself. And
so why not just subsidize it?
Well, that would be last year, right?
Right.
Well, no, we will continue to subsidize it. And in fact, because of the fact that there's still this deficit, at some point we probably need to be honest with everybody and to say, okay, this isn't really an enterprise fund.
So you think it'll change?
I don't know. That the council has been sometimes turned on a dime with solid waste, or most of the time just keep, you know, delaying things. We do have a different council and a different time, but for some reason we just keep for 5 years generating headline after headline after headline and have done very little. Now, we did do some 2 years ago. We've made some progress this summer. It's just it seems at times painfully slow toward closing that gap.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio. He'll take your question at 309-438-8910. You have the cost savings on the solid waste front, and during your pre-meeting work session, you also learned of increasing revenue. Is Bloomington turning the corner on its budget problems?
I hope so. We you can never really be sure, because especially in this economy, we thought in my first year as mayor that revenues looked like they were actually ticking up some, a little more than the inflation rate, looked like we were okay. Then they went back below the inflation rate and our costs kept going up. So now it looks like things are getting a little bit better. So I'm cautiously optimistic as we move forward. But we certainly, as I say, we have a new council. We are really looking at things, everything we've done in the past, try to recalibrate that. Certainly as we write contracts and other agreements, we are absolutely going to protect the city. But the one critical thing we have to do to make sure that we do, we've got to grow the local economy. We can't leave this to chance. Perhaps the most important of public goods other than public safety is growing the local economy. And for example, we talked last night about property acquisition, and some people don't seem to understand. Especially when you've got a budget problem, you've got to acquire strategic properties to take full advantage of them in the economy. And that's what we're aggressively doing. We have to move decisively, deliberately, and be aggressive in the international political economy, or we're not going to achieve our full potential.
So you want to grow the economy, yet you're not lining up with Normal on their sales tax priorities, some of which include funding economic development efforts.
Well, again, that's a separate kind of question. I'm sure we'll talk about those things as part of an intergovernmental agreement. The difference between us and Normal, of course, we both allocated a quarter for mental health, and there are some things that we're going to circle back around with Connect Transit and making sure that we've got great facilities and perhaps Sunday service as well. So we're going to be agreeing on some things, but we have a clear structural deficit that Normal at this point does not have. In the past, Normal was pretty good about paying their bills. That's why. For many years, our costs went up and our taxes or revenues or fees did not go up.
So back to the increasing revenue streams that the uptick in revenue that Bloomington has seen from some of its revenue streams, income tax, sales tax, food and beverage tax, package, liquor, many more revenue sources are up. What accounts for the increases, do you think?
Well, it is we're certainly getting the sense that the economy is turning around a little bit, and our economy is stronger than most any other in downstate Illinois. But this has not been seasonally adjusted. We need to go through at least a complete year to be confident at all, especially since we've had such budget issues. The biggest problem, or I should say biggest surprise, people ask me, what's your biggest surprise as being mayor? Bar none, is I didn't think I would have to struggle and fight so much just to keep our doors open. And that I didn't think that was the case. I think we're getting beyond that.
309-438-8910. Phone lines are open. In the studio is Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. We're talking about bulky waste, solid waste, some revenue increases the city is experiencing. And now we're going to talk about police body cams. You can join this conversation at 309-438-8910. Terry, how was the pilot proposal for police body cams received by aldermen?
Well, actually, they were very interested in it. It was one of those rare unanimous votes that we had, 9-0
vote.
And so the council agreed that we should explore this. We had the chief explain some of the issues associated with this, and I can tell you at every U.S. Conference of Mayors, this comes up. I mean, Burnsville, Minnesota was one of those that's a champion in this, and they've had some of the very same issues. Now, not all communities are running to embrace this. We're, I think, cautiously moving forward. We do want to make sure that we protect people's right to privacy. We also have to make sure that we have redaction software. There are many concerns as we move forward, but the cities that have adopted it by and large have found reductions in problems and injuries by officers and by civilians. When citizens know that they're being filmed, they're a little less likely to attack or push, be involved in rough behavior with police and police themselves too, and being human, they realize that they're being taped. So for a lot of reasons, there are some possible benefits to this.
So are you saying that the checks and balances brought by this technology these checks and balances are needed in Bloomington?
The checks and balances?
As a result of the technology and the body cam that officers would wear.
I think they're needed everywhere. Now, whether or not every community decides to push forward is a different story. It was like the cameras on cars. At first, many people were suspicious of them. Some police officers throughout the United States, many of them were concerned. Now, I don't know that it's universally approved, but it's got very, very wide acceptance. I suspect that will be the case as we work out some of the privacy and other logistical issues with respect to body cams.
I just had a 9-0 vote on the body cam pilot program. It is a pilot program, just $29,000 in federal grant to fund this at first. Any idea what this might cost on an ongoing basis if the city decides to move beyond the pilot?
We are going to be getting some estimates on that shortly. It could be, you know, in the range of over $100,000, you know, in a $186 million budget, that might not seem like a lot, but we are obviously at the point where we're trying to economize in every way possible.
309-438-8910. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio. He'll take your questions. Again, that number, 309-438-8910. Let's talk sidewalks. Another 9-0 vote to accept a sidewalk master plan. Can you characterize the condition of the city's sidewalks?
They're terrible. Okay. I think, you know, not every street, not every block.
In older neighborhoods, though, they could use some help.
They're terrible, absolutely. And so that's the one thing that takeaway from Jim Karch, our public works director last night, that I think is really important is that if as we move toward taking that quarter penny of the sales tax and putting it into our streets, and it's, let's say we decide to leverage that for bonds, I am going to absolutely be a strong proponent of taking that and doing about a $25 million street resurfacing program. The thing that we're going to have to realize is we're going to then have to also spend some more money upgrading the sidewalks. Now, that dollar amount is much less, several hundred thousand dollars.
But I was surprised to hear that some of the ADA ramps that are already installed are no longer compliant.
That's right.
So what, do they change the angle of the ramp?
I don't know the details, but it was several years ago. There were some problems, and
so again, not only do you have to put ramps in where there are no ramps, you have to go back and
redo ramps in many areas.
The sidewalk cuts where there are.
Yeah, many times as mayor, it feels like you're never really stopping the cleaning up of the messes of the past. So, but again, you just got to move forward.
So the cost is $600,000 per year for the next 10 years. The council didn't vote to fund it, only to accept the master plan.
Right.
We see money set aside in the next budget cycle for some sidewalks?
Almost. We have to. Right. And I do have a line item veto. If it's not in there, I'll send it back.
So it's that big a priority for you?
Well, it has to be. I mean, obviously, streets and infrastructure are there, but you can't do the streets if you don't also make some improvements in your sidewalks. So they all have to go hand in hand. It's not as if you can take one without the other.
Downtown redevelopment is back on the table. Jeff Gablehausen.
Absolutely. Well, it's never been off the table, but we got a new wave of it.
Sure. It sort of went under the table for a while. It's now back being discussed again. Jeff Gablehausen, who had made the original proposal to redevelop a downtown city block near the Commerce Bank building, will be circling back with the council during the next committee meeting of the whole. What will he say?
He's got another fairly exciting project with a very much the same space, and that is the block that would link the Coliseum to our Route 66 Visitor Center in the McLean County History Museum, the kind of ground zero, if you will, of downtown, which is a critical, critical block. Again, this is regardless whether it's Gablehausen's proposal or some of the others that may very well be on that we may hear, yet this is really important to grow our local economy, take full advantage of our downtown, and this will help reduce some of the red ink in the operations of the Coliseum and, again, obviously make downtown more of a destination. So I do support it at 500 feet. I want to see what Gablehausen's proposal is. I want to dig deep into that. Obviously, the last one we did not pursue.
And the last one, the hang-up was that he was going to develop a shovel-ready lot that the city would then market.
Right. It was a two-phase process. I think what we're getting here is a single-phase process.
So he may be... I don't know if you can tell me. I don't know if you know, but he may be the developer. He may be coming here and saying, this is the project. I'm going to tear it down. We're going to build this.
Right. Oh, and or he would at least very likely have an agreement with someone else.
Or another developer.
And they would work together on this. Yes. And so, these are certainly possible exciting things. Since we've got the Route 66 Visitor Center, though, and we're taking more full advantage of that Route 66 visitors traffic.
Lots of visitors from all over the world.
From all over the world. There's a lot of renewed interest, serious interest in investing in our downtown and investing in that whole Route 66 corridor, including, for example, the Electrolux site, which is now almost totally demolished. So we are making progress. Sometimes it's not as fast as I'd like, but we are moving forward. I mean, Bloomington is a great place, and we are going to leverage our assets.
The next committee of the whole meeting is when?
I believe that's Monday. That's correct.
So this is Jeff Gabelhausen will be talking to the council very soon.
Correct.
David Bentley also will be addressing the city on downtown redevelopment. What does he have in mind? And is there any concern about working with David Bentley based on his past lawsuits with the city over TIF districts?
Well, let me answer the first question first. Yes, absolutely. When somebody's spent, I believe he has said, $1 million in legal fees suing the city for 20 years, and you go back and forth, there are definitely some issues. And I don't mean to whether or not to judge what he has or hasn't done in the past, because the city may very well have deserved to be sued many times in the past. What we have now, though, is a situation where Mr. Bentley in several cases has acquired properties and has not kept them up. And in fact, we C2 East building, I believe we had 2 feet of water in it in the basement last year. So we've got code enforcement issues. There is definitely some trust that needs to go forward. Now, we will write contracts that will protect us, even if we see that there may be
something. So willing to hear him out.
I'm willing to hear him out.
But proceed cautiously.
Right. Yeah, he is proposing, in a sense, a smaller boutique hotel at the Pantograph site, and we'll hear the details of that and other things on Monday evening.
During the work session, what did you hear about council priorities coming from the Bloomington Budget Task Force? Where are they on cuts moving forward?
Well, they did have the meeting, almost 2 weeks ago now, where the council talked about some of these things. And so the council's definitely moving toward trying to come up with more specifics as to where we're going to make service cuts. And some of those were discussed just in principle last night. Alderwoman Schmidt threw out some of them. And so as we move through the budget process, keep in mind, we've made tremendous progress because we're farther along now than we were as we finished the budget in my first 2 years as mayor, because our fiscal year ends April 30th. So we've made tremendous progress with the budget task force.
So you're months ahead.
Yes, we're compared to the past. Again, we're not going back to the way we did business. And there were definitely a lot of fits and starts because obviously I'm someone who's not terribly patient. I like to make things happen. We've had a council in the past that had more of a culture of, I would describe it as slow decision making, fiddling around, navel gazing, whatever. That's not happening now. We're making progress for the future. And so it may never be as quickly as I'd like it to be, of course, but we are moving forward, and this council's really getting it done.
Mayor Renner, as always, thanks for your time during Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Mike.
Terry Renner is the mayor of Bloomington and joins us following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, serving the Bloomington Normal community for 35 years. 2025 East Lincoln in Bloomington, dedicated to providing excellence in senior living. On the web at westminstervillageinc.com. This is GLT.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Reverend Osagyefu Sekou has been front and center in ongoing protests in Ferguson since the shooting of Michael Brown, and he thinks the incident was the tipping point in the tense relationship between police and minorities. Sekou gives the annual Hibbert R. Roberts Lecture at Illinois State University Thursday night. St. Louis native, he's a prominent activist, author, and theologian who was a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Education and Research Institute when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson in August of 2014. His address on Thursday is titled A New Civil Rights Movement, Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, and the Future of Nonviolence. GLT's John Norton talked with Sekou via Skype from his home in St. Louis.
First, the sheer act of leaving his body in the street for 4.5 hours. The level of disrespect was just untenable. And then secondly, that there was a rage and a level of discontent that was boiling under the surface in Ferguson. There are 21,000 people in Ferguson, 15,000 African Americans, 10,000 of them had arrest warrants in 2014. In 2013, over 23,000 tickets and arrest warrants issued, given the fact that the Ferguson's budget, about 1/4 of his budget, was coming from tickets. And so minor, quote unquote, offenses were leading people to jail and have to deal with enormous amounts of debt as it relates to the municipal government ticketing process. And so when you add that up, and then the constant harassment of young folks by the police in Ferguson, it boiled over once they left his body in the street for 4.5 hours.
So really, because that stuff didn't come out till later, it was probably more the body in the street that really caught the nation's and world's attention?
Yes. In addition to leaving his body in the street, then they were going to put his body in a trunk of a car versus put, and then the SUV, which was not much more dignified, was the response to the community saying that if you put his body in the trunk of a car, there's going to be a problem. Then they allowed dogs to urinate on the makeshift memorial that was fertilized with his blood. That was planted in his blood. And then the hyper-militarized response of the police to young folks engaging in their democratic rights that are protected under the First Amendment. And so you add all of that up, it became an unfortunate perfect storm that led to the fact that you and I are having this conversation over a year later.
Well, you've been heavily involved in the ongoing protests in Ferguson, not just, you know, in the week or two afterwards. And your role in those protests, and I would imagine other protests around the country, was and continues to be as clergy. Why do you feel the need to be, quote, clergy during the protests and demonstrations as opposed to just being, you know, a regular schmo?
Well, I am a regular schmo who happens to be a clergy person.
Right.
In that, the reality is that the tradition that I come out of, the way in which I understand Jesus, in terms of the context of Christian orthodoxy, right, that God became flesh. And so that God chose to become flesh in the body of an unwed teenage mother among an unimportant people in an unimportant part of the world living under occupation. And that Jesus was subject to the arbitrary policing of the Roman Empire and was executed by the state. And according to the Christian mythos, he defeated the empire by way of resurrection. And so how I understand Jesus as a nonviolent revolutionary resisting occupation, it stands to reason that Jesus calls us to be in the street. And that in the streets of Ferguson, I was born again, and that I met God for myself, and that God is angry, and that God is queer, and God is a woman. God has tattoos on God's face. And so for me, it is a logical extension of a certain kind of theology of which I subscribe to.
To your comment about Jesus resisting occupation, you've often compared the situation in Ferguson, and I would guess by extension, you know, other places in America, Chicago, Oakland, Baltimore, you've compared these places with Palestine, both currently and Palestine of the time of Jesus. Why do you see it that way?
Well, so when you look at the material conditions, right, first century at Palestine is an occupied territory whereby first century Palestinian Jews are subject to arbitrary the violence of the state, subject to high levels of taxing, subject experiencing high forms of hunger and malnutrition and dislocation. And so those three features, when you look at the numbers of hunger and poverty in America, when you look at the way in which police function as occupying forces in black communities, those for me are direct links and make that comparison. And then in the contemporary moment, having spent time in Palestine in 2012, the material conditions that the Palestinians live under in Israeli occupation, particularly in the West Bank, looked very similar, combined with the police chiefs in many of the police chiefs in the greater St. Louis region were trained in Israel or trained by Israeli forces. And many of the tactics that were used on us in the streets of Ferguson are the same military tactics that I saw in Israel being used, particularly in the community Nabi Sela. And then lastly, in terms of a material point, that the same company that makes the tear gas that was shot at us in Ferguson makes the tear gas that was shot at us when I was in Palestine. And in the case of Von Derrick Myers, we're upon the 1-year anniversary of his killing by a off-duty police officer working for a company that is a part of the parent company that has ties to the organization that runs the prisons in Palestine. And so both kind of theologically at a material level, we see that these things are both a part and parcel of a reality that young black folks are experiencing in America and that young Palestinians are experiencing under Israeli occupation.
At one point, I don't know if you still feel this way, but at one point you said that clergy, including yourself, had betrayed black youth. And I think that was a time around Ferguson. What did you mean that you had and other clergy had betrayed black youth?
I mean, when you look at the way in which, one, that the predominance of a kind of prosperity theology that is at work in America, two, the nature of the way in which black folks find themselves trying to make some sense of the world, and that one of the roles that the black church has always played is the constitution of a black self, black self-dignity and black respectability. And that the predominance of respectability politics, i.e. pull your pants up, dress well, the system won't bother you, and combined with a clergy have often sided with and been in negotiating with police agencies. And so in that sense, we have betrayed them because the black freedom struggle has always placed a premium on black people, on black youth. And then my experience in the context of the black church in the rural South and then secondarily here in the St. Louis area has been one in which I was celebrated, loved, and cared for. And so that, for many young people, is not their experience.
You're very involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. It's a movement that came out of the Trayvon Martin killing and really picked up steam with, you know, the killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and maybe John Crawford. The movement is getting pushback from especially white conservatives, but it's also getting bewilderment from some especially white liberals who thought maybe they understood and identified. What is the message of Black Lives Matter? And in your opinion, why are so many people on both sides of the aisle having such a difficult time digesting the message?
Well, I think that part of it is that in terms of Black Lives Matters as the organization, and I want to make a distinction between Black Lives Matters, the organization, and the movement for Black Lives. Okay. Black Lives Matters, the organization, is led by two queer black women and their comrade. It articulates a vision of the world that makes a centrality of black humanity. We live in a moment whereby the articulation of the obvious is revolutionary. So saying that Black Lives Matters, right, it disrupts the discourse, right? Just saying it, because people respond not by saying, yes, Black Lives Matter and other matters matter too. They respond by saying all lives matter. So it's to erase black suffering and black misery and to subjugate it to a kind of false post-racial discourse. And then the other piece, I think, has to do with that it has jettisoned respectability politics. So it's just not simply about negotiating with the powers. It's just not simply about preachers and cufflinks and suits marching, but it's about being led by queer young black women. It's been led by folks who are, many of them are quote unquote unchurched and have a deep distrust, if not disdain, for the church. So it represents a new moment. And so it's unsettling to a lot of people because we have a reified and conservative notion of what the civil rights movement looked like, and particularly what the role of Martin Luther King was and his relationship to the powers.
Well, and that was my observation, too, is that it does feel different from the what I identify as the civil rights movement, say, from the 50s and 60s. And that the people today seem to be not embracing mainstream institutions. And is that pretty much what you're saying?
Yes, that most of them have either been rejected because they are queer, have called into question various forms of fundamentalism, and don't find it as a space that appeals to their both their humanity and their spiritual need.
So do you think it's going to work?
Dear brother, that's for the historians in heaven to answer. All I know is that they will continue to kill us and the people will continue to resist.
When Ferguson happened, and it was all over the television screens all over the world, what I noticed about the coverage itself, it seemed to be focused on the violence itself. That was always the lead, whether it was television or radio. It was like, well, there was very little violence in Ferguson last night. It was like the first sentence out. It's like they were fixated on the violence itself and not on what was going on. It's almost like people couldn't understand where that anger, where that comes from. Can you address that a little bit?
Well, I would just simply respond by saying, if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention.
Well, you mentioned Democratic Socialist, a self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist is Bernie Sanders. He's running for president. And he got into a little bit of a thing at the Netroots Nation with the Black Lives Matter movement. And he's always been talking about the high unemployment rate of blacks, the incarceration, high incarceration rate of blacks, and how this is a huge problem. But it seems to be that Black Lives Matter is saying yes, but it's more than that.
I want to pull back and look at it broader. Right now, what we have, if the progressive movement in this kind of particular age of Ferguson, that the best that they can produce is a 70-year-old white brother who's done some pretty progressive things in his life, it speaks to the levity, the level of paucity and vacuousness that is at work in our America, in our political life. That we have a string of mediocre candidates, recycled insiders who are more and more right-wing and centrist in their politics. And while Bernie Sanders has good politics on the domestic front, his silence on the American imperial project and the empire in terms of his military bases, his silence on the question of Israeli occupation, which is the most burning issue in the Middle East, reveals to us that there's just a level of mediocrity and that there we are faced with an anemic liberalism and a cowardly mainstream political discourse.
Okay. Well, you're committed to nonviolent protests, as was Dr. King, and referring to the title of your talk here at Illinois State University, how is the future of nonviolent protest either different or going to be different than what nonviolent protest was in the past?
So part of it has to do with just the historical context, right? That the vast majority of Martin Luther King marches depended upon state intervention, right? Depended on laws, depended on protections. We see the rescinding of those protections when local police officers come and attack protesters, both Birmingham and Selma in particular. That King begins to articulate a militant nonviolence in his last book, Trumpet of Conscience, which came out a few months after his assassination. And he begins to articulate a militant nonviolent civil disobedience that it was preoccupied with a direct confrontation with the state to prick the conscience of the nation in order to create some form of public policy and public discourse in order to deal with the various forms of state violence that we were encountering in the 1960s. And so this idea of kind of mandated these kind of quietude marches, these kind of somber marches, whereas that a lot of young folks are more raucous, that the musical undergirding of this era of protest is not the black church, it is hip hop. And so hip hop has a different tendency around boisterousness, around polyrhythms that are also connected to black musical forms, but also articulate a different level of rage and anxiety at work in public space. And so for me, militant nonviolent civil disobedience is a capturing of the best of King's militant nonviolent tradition and applying it to this particular moment.
Okay. Final question. When you were called, when you got the call to minister, is what you're doing now part of that calling initially? Did you hear that or did that come later?
Oh, well, I came out of a tradition of black folks who loved deeply, who believed deeply in the life of the mind and in justice. And so when I go back to Arkansas, where I was raised until I was 15 before moving to St. Louis, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and it is their expectation of me.
That's Reverend Osage Fuseku talking via Skype with WGLT's John Norton. Seku delivers the annual Hibbert R. Roberts Lecture at 7 p.m. Thursday at Illinois State University's Capon Auditorium at Edwards Hall. His talk is titled A New Civil Rights Movement, Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, and the Future of Nonviolence. You're listening to Sound Ideas. District Congressman Rodney Davis of Taylorville, whose district includes part of McLean County, is one of two Central Illinois lawmakers in Cuba this week on a trade mission. IPR's Amanda Vinicky has the story.
A steady stream of American elected officials have traveled to Cuba since the two countries restored diplomatic ties over the summer. Arkansas's governor was the first governor to go last month. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner hasn't yet, and maybe he won't. Of course, his hands are full with the budget right now, though as a candidate, he did talk about traveling to increase foreign exports and investments. But a pair of Illinois politicians are in the early waves of traveling to the island nation. Congresswoman Sherry Bustos and Congressman Rodney Davis are both in Cuba now on a trade mission. I spoke with Bustos and Davis last week before they left on their trip. Let's start out hearing from Representative Bustos, a Democrat from the Quad Cities, about why she's going.
We are entirely focused on Illinois and on agriculture. Our end goal would be, you know, what can we come back with as far as future jobs, future opportunities to export our goods and try to grow our numbers and what we're sending to Cuba, especially along the lines of corn, soybean, maybe hogs, et cetera. But we want to have some success stories out of this.
It's my understanding that right now, despite a long embargo, of course, that agriculture has been exempt. So why are things any different for Illinois and particularly for products like corn and soy?
Well, they're not totally exempted. I mean, we've been able to export corn and soy going back to about 2000. But the problem is that the folks in Cuba have to pay in advance for any of those exports. They can't get any credit. So that has really hurt us over time. We hit a peak in about 2008 with our exports, and that has decreased steadily. So we're really at a fraction of where we were back in the early days of being able to export. So this is a bipartisan trade mission. Rodney Davis out of the Springfield area is Republican. I'm a Democrat. The two of us were the only congressional members who serve on the Ag Committee. And so we have partnered with the Soybean Association, the corn growers, the Illinois Chamber has a presence there. And, you know, we want to focus on ag because it's the number one industry in the state of Illinois. And in the congressional district I serve, it's the number one industry in central and northwestern Illinois as well.
I got more information on that from Republican Representative Rodney Davis, who's from Taylorville.
We've been able as a country to sell ag exports to Cuba for many years. As a matter of fact, I was in Cuba in 2005 as part of a delegation and a staff delegation that gave me an opportunity to talk to those who would want to import American products. And it'll be interesting to go back and be able to see what progress we've made and, in some cases, what progress has been lacking and how we can ask the Castro government to open up more freedoms for their citizens and also take advantage of great products produced right in Illinois.
I asked Davis what sort of audience he'll have with Cuba's leaders when he arrives there, and to explain a little bit more about agriculture as it relates to the embargo. What's the status?
Yeah, I know we will not be meeting with the Castros, but we'll be meeting with other leaders within their government / export agency, which in a communist nation like Cuba, unfortunately, is run by the government. These are issues that we're going to tackle, especially an issue related to the fact that Cuba has imported less American products since the president made his decision to loosen some trade barriers. You know, there are still some barriers that Congress will have to look at with credit issues and how the Cubans are eligible to pay for products from America. And those are things that hopefully we'll be able to discuss and then take up when we return back to Washington.
Agricultural products have been exempt. They've been allowed to be imported to Cuba. So how does the change in relations with Cuba matter at all for farmers and Illinois' vast agricultural industry right now? And is there any sort of specific goal attached to that with this trip?
Well, things right now haven't changed as much since I was there even in 2005. And what we're hoping to do is work together in a bipartisan way to come up with some solutions to look at some common sense changes to ensure that Cubans, number one, can have access to a plentiful food supply, which, frankly, under the form of government they're living under, and the sheer fact that they're an island nation, they have a problem feeding their population. We need to ensure that, the Cubans who would demand products, food products from Illinois, ought to have an opportunity to get them, and that's part of the reason we're there.
Is this still politically dicey? There's a Republican candidate for president who's high in the polls there, Marco Rubio, who doesn't like what the Obama administration has done in terms of refostering ties with Cuba.
No, I agree. It's a very difficult situation for us to navigate here in Washington, too. I remember some of my colleagues from the South Florida area have issues that are personal issues, family issues, issues that date back to the pre-Castro era in Cuba. And I got to respect those issues that they have. But I also come to the same conclusion that many have, is that what we've been doing over the last 50-plus years has not been working. I think Marco Rubio and I have the same goal. That's to rid the Cubans of the Castros and the failed communist regime. We just feel the need to go about it differently. I believe that the Castros are going to remain in power if the embargo is still in place and if the status quo remains. I think the only way to free the Cuban people is to invest American dollars and have the American economy help free them economically and give them access to things that they never knew even existed.
Also part of the trade mission, leaders from the State Chamber of Commerce, Farm Bureau, and Corn and Soybean Councils. Bustos and Davis aren't the only elected officials from Illinois to have made the trip to Cuba in the recent past. Back in January, before the U.S. and Cuba normalized relations, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin went with other Democrats. And back in 1999, then-Governor George Ryan traveled to Cuba for 5 days with a contingent of lawmakers, teachers, high-level Caterpillar and Archer Daniels Midland employees, and journalists. At the time, as one newspaper put it, Ryan was the first sitting U.S. governor to travel to Cuba since Castro seized power in 1959. Representatives Bustos and Davis are in Cuba through Wednesday. Back stateside, I'm Amanda Vinicky with Illinois Public Radio.
And I'm Mike McCurdy with GLT's Sound Ideas. Every day, you invite GLT into your home through your radio or smartphone. During this fund drive campaign, GLT is inviting you to help build a home. Every contribution to GLT will provide 2x4s to Habitat for Humanity thanks to Heinz Supply. It's our Listen, Pledge, Build partnership.
Hi, I'm Sherry Bruin. Thanks for your contribution to GLT. You're providing lumber for 3 new Habitat homes like mine.
Learn more about our Listen, Pledge, Build partnership and make your contribution at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. Michelle Massey had her hands full running a ballet company with her husband, but when personal tragedy struck, she was moved to do even more and help animals in our community. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of Animal House.
Animals are in need of a good home, a safe place, or just someone to help and love them. Animal rescue groups step in. One of the newest rescue groups in the Twin Cities is My Lovable Angels. Founded in 2011 by Michelle Massey, the No Kill Rescue was created in honor of Massey's late sister, Leslie, who, like Michelle, was a great animal lover. Massey says the work creating My Lovable Angels helped her deal with the grief over losing her sister.
My rescue is a living memory to my sister, and I have found that the reason I started my rescue really touches a lot of people, and they're connecting with that. Like, they've lost either a pet or another loved one, and they can really relate to that emptiness, and it's just helping to fill a really nice void.
So was your sister really an animal lover, that this is something that maybe she might have wanted to become involved in?
Well, she's very much into animals and children. She was a teacher and worked with abused children and just always was out there, you know, giving of herself. Yeah, our relationship goes way back as far as animals, and she rescued one while she was still in college. She went to college here and brought it on my doorstep. Said, Shelly, you're the only one I can bring this puppy to. They are going to shoot it when it comes back. I'm like, okay. So that was my first experience with little pit bull.
Where'd you come up with the name, My Lovable Angels?
Well, I needed something also to tie us. So my name is Michelle. So my lovable was Leslie's, you know, initial. And then angels because she's, you know, watching us from above. And also has a second meaning. Lovable in our rescue is L-O-V-E-A-B-L-E. And so it means love is able to do anything.
How difficult was it, Michelle, to get this started?
It was hard. You know, we did a lot of research. My husband helped me with research on, we've founded, you know, other nonprofit organizations. So that was the easy part. But running a rescue, getting involved in that was a totally different animal for us. And so a lot of research, a lot of talking to other rescues and did the paperwork and just said, okay, here we go. Obviously, when we first started, the first fosters came into our home. And since then, you know, we've grown to having 18 to 20 different fosters throughout the state.
So you don't have one particular location. The animals are fostered out in homes.
In actual homes, yes. One day, I would like to have a small facility. Not that that's where they would be housed, but intake, sometimes quarantining, you know, things like that, that just would allow us to save more lives while we get, you know, them into foster homes, because I pull from many death rows, euthanasia dates and times, like right up to the last minute a lot of times. But we're primarily foster based. So animals, I pull them, they come in, they go directly into foster homes, which actually is good for the animals because they are in a loving home. They are getting help getting through their issues, separation anxiety, you know, just a number of abuse cases.
So they get socialized.
Yes.
Have you had any really terrible situations where you thought maybe this animal cannot be placed in a home?
We had one that was a really, really tough case. But in situations like that, our fosters then just will be the foster home, you know, until they pass, because I'm 100% no kill. Obviously, there are extenuating circumstances, you know, severe illness, you know, things like that.
Where do these animals come from? Do they all come from kill shelters, or do people just find an animal and say, oh, here, Michelle, help me with this animal?
Now it's becoming a lot of both. Primarily, you know, high kill facilities. We also do pull locally. We get a lot of owner surrenders. And now that the word is out that how really awesome my rescue is, our volunteers are absolutely phenomenal, the word is spreading. And we're just getting contacted every day with people needing help, you know, for a variety of reasons. And I feel really honored that they have contacted us to entrust their animals, you know, to find forever homes for them.
Michelle, how do you go about fundraising? Have you looked into perhaps having a membership program like other animal shelters or rescues, like the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary that's out in Utah?
Oh, we haven't done that yet. We've done like donations for different services. We've done raffles. We've done like the GoFundMe things, but we really are in need of funds, because my rescue's motto is all will be welcome, all will be loved unconditionally, and all will not need to fear again. And with that comes a commitment to the animals we pull. We have some who will have to live out in foster care because they have Cushing's disease and cancer, and we, you know, can't adopt them out, but they deserve a loving home for the rest of their life. And so our medical bills, you know, are quite high. So we could really use assistance. We have a PayPal they can donate through, or just send a check to our business address.
You also run USA Ballet.
Yes,
with your husband, Ken.
Yes.
Which is in itself pretty time consuming. Mm-hmm. How do you balance running My Lovable Angels and USA Ballet?
Pretty much no sleep.
Okay.
They're both nonprofit organizations, but both groups have a wonderful support base. And just over time, you know, you just get in a good system. And you just, you know, it just works. It just works. They're both my passions. And, you know, God has made a way for me to do both. It's just working out really nicely for me.
If people want to help, they can financially support you.
Yes.
Are there other ways that they can support you, like donating materials, that sort of thing?
Yes, we can use supplies for dogs and cats. So anything from litter to canned food to toys, you know, anything like that. So any dog or cat related item, they can definitely donate. We can pick it up or they can drop it off at our downtown office. I know there are a lot of groups out there, community groups, businesses, things like that, that maybe are looking for a cause to help and to support and, you know, fundraise for that. I would really appreciate that if, you know, anybody in town would, you know, like to take on My Lovable Angels as their fundraising cause for a season. And then the financial aspect, we are 501c3, so it is a tax benefit for those that might want to donate financially.
Is there a particular success story, Michelle, that you're very proud of with My Lovable Angels?
Oh my goodness. That's just so hard because everyone has a special spot, you know, in our hearts and their own stories. One of the ones that sits with me, and sorry if I'm going to tear up, is a dog that I never actually got to meet. He was used as a bait dog.
For fighting.
For fighting. No other rescue was stepping up, and it was in another state where I pull from, and actually was sitting in its crate or in its concrete room with dried blood on the floor. And so I said, I'm pulling. They picked it up for me, took it to the vet, and gave him wonderful care, IVs, just love. And then he ended up passing, but he passed without pain anymore. He was loved. And so his name was Django. He's just one of the many stories that, you know, my rescue has. We have happy endings too, but that was just, it was just awful. It was awful and really opened my eyes to a lot of the horror that's out there.
Do you really feel like you've made an impact, that you're really starting to make inroads in helping animals?
Yeah, I do. I really, really do. Our first year, we homed about 80-some. The next year, we almost doubled. And this year, we're going to easily double that as well. And getting animals from hoarding situations where they've had over 70 animals in a single home and seeing them so shut down and then become a dog, act like a dog, play like a dog, and then put them in a forever home where they're never going to have any worries. I mean, it's just amazing. Amazing to me what love and patience can do.
That's Michelle Massey, founder of My Lovable Angels. She says the organization runs well thanks to help from volunteers who take on a variety of essential tasks, from running the Facebook page to helping with fundraisers. Massey says new volunteers are welcome. And of course, My Lovable Angels is always looking for good homes for the rescued animals, including the sweet cat that's the Animal House Pet of the Week. It's Athena. Just in time for Halloween, this gorgeous black cat is a goddess among felines. Around 1 year old, Athena is a well-rounded cat, both independent and a committed snuggler. This even-tempered pussycat is great with other cats and with dogs. If you'd like to add Athena to your home, you can find her at My Lovable Angels. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Learn more about Animal Rescue Saturday at 1:30 p.m. at the Normal Theater with the screening of Redemption, the story of the rise of no-kill shelters. Nathan Winograd, the father of the no-kill shelter movement, is attending the screening. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find an Animal House archive. It's also where you can find past editions of Sound Ideas, including this episode, with help from Laura Kennedy, John Norton, and Willis Kern. Also, thanks to Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner for his time. Share what you think about Sound Ideas at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us news@WGLT.org. And we're on the Twitter. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal News and Ideas.